From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Moscow demanded an explanation from Kiev authorities after a Russian checkpoint on the border between the two countries came under shelling on Friday. This according to a statement from the Russian Foreign Ministry. Earlier Friday, the Russian checkpoint of Novoshetinsk in the Rostov region had been shelled by mortars, according to reports by Russia's border service, which said the rounds came from the Ukrainian side. A Russian customs service employee was reportedly injured in the fire. The shelling occurred as Lugansk self-defense forces clashed with Ukrainian military, joined by the Ukrainian National Guard, who launched mortar fire that hit the checkpoint. While the main target of the shelling was the Ukrainian border checkpoint Dolyansky, controlled by the militia, several mortars hit Russia's Rostov region, according to the report. Following the incident, the Russian Foreign Ministry filed a protest with Kiev demanding an immediate explanation and investigation into the shelling. White House spokesperson Josh Earnest put the blame for the unrest in the region on Russia, accusing Russia of allowing the provision of arms and materiel from Russia to Ukraine across the Russian-Ukrainian border, and called on Russia to, quote, stop supporting the militants who are fomenting so much violence in that country, closed quote. He also accused Russia of a buildup of forces along the border.
Unfortunately, there is mounting evidence that shows a buildup of Russian military forces near the border with Ukraine, contrary to the statements by Kremlin officials. We do not see any evidence that the Russian military units arriving to the region are connected to any type of border security mission. And further, reports from Moscow that the Russian Defense Ministry is considering creating military cordons in eastern Ukraine are also troubling. So we're monitoring the situation closely, and we will not accept any use of Russian military forces under any pretext in eastern Ukraine. After all, eastern Ukraine is a sovereign country, and interference by outside countries is a violation of their sovereignty and territorial integrity. There's one other point that I actually want to raise here that is also important and of some concern. In addition, inflammatory statements, such as those by Foreign Minister Lavrov earlier this week, in which he described ethnic cleansing taking place in Ukraine, are simply false. We see these statements for what they are, an attempt to create pretext for further illegal Russian intervention in Ukraine. In fact, responsibility for the deterioration in the human rights situation in Ukraine lies with the armed separatists who are targeting the population and their backers in Russia. Multiple reports by human rights monitors over the past several months have indicated that armed separatist groups supported by Russia are perpetrating an increasing number of killings, abductions, and other violent human rights abuses in eastern Ukraine. And the same is happening in Crimea under Russian occupation. What the president said in Europe, and actually had the opportunity to communicate directly to President Putin, was that there is an opportunity for Russia to play a constructive role in this process. There's no reason for the people of Ukraine to have to choose between good relations with Russia and good relations with the West. In fact, there's an opportunity for them to have both. But they're only going to have those solid relations if Russia respects the sovereignty of Ukraine and works in a cooperative fashion to bring some stability to the security situation.
His accusations were supplemented with accusations from State Department spokesperson Jen Psaki.
Earlier today, Russian ambassador to the United Nations denied that Russian armed vehicles were crossing into Ukraine. How do you respond to that?
Well, I have a couple of updated details here, so let me run through those for you. We are confident, as we said last Friday, that Russia last week sent tanks and rocket launchers from a deployment site in southwest Russia into eastern Ukraine. We have information that additional tanks have been prepared for departure from this same deployment site, and that's more recently. We also have information that Russia has accumulated artillery at a deployment site in southwest Russia, including a type of artillery utilized by Ukrainian forces but no longer in Russia's active forces, and believe Russia may soon provide this equipment to separatist fighters. And we are obviously closely watching what we are seeing on the ground. I would also point you to the comments of NATO Secretary General Rasmussen yesterday, who said we're seeing a new Russian military buildup of at least a few thousand more troops deployed at the Ukrainian border, and there are troop maneuvers near the border with Ukraine. And separately, we have our own information that Russia has redeployed military forces to its border with Ukraine. This is the closest Russian troops have come to the Ukrainian territory since their invasion of Crimea. So that is our view from the United States.
Russia's ambassador to the UN addressed the accusations at a press conference late Friday.
Today, the U.S. Added seven individuals to its sanctions list and said that Russia is moving troops back to the border of with Ukraine, and said that, you know, U.S. is always ready to impose more sanctions. And following Valerie Amos's close briefing to the Council about the situation in Ukraine, she said there is no humanitarian crisis yet seen. So it appears that Russia's position on how dire the situation is not being agreed. It's not a view that's shared by anyone else. What's your response to that? And what do you say about the conflict or the situation regarding Ukraine, has it now reached another new phase where there are tensions mounting again about more sanctions against Russia?
Well, I don't want to. I mean, sanctions, it's their thing. If they want to go down that road, it's up to them. It's completely wrong. It's not serving any useful purpose. Now, our colleagues have their way. When they discuss humanitarian issues, it was embarrassing to me to be there in that room when they were kept asking, but it's not really a humanitarian catastrophe, is it? It's not really a humanitarian catastrophe. According to UN human rights person who did a briefing in Geneva, I think 2 days ago, they said 257 civilians killed as of June 18. Is it what? Catastrophe? It's not no problem? Even one colleague in the council, even though later on she refused that she said that, but I and some others heard it quite clearly, said, it's not such a big deal for the Security Council to deal with. Of course, more people have been killed in South Sudan. More in South Sudan. In Mali, probably more. In Central African Republic, more people have been killed. But does it mean that we need to disregard it as a problem? I think one good thing, useful thing, which we have done, we're able to attract the attention of international humanitarian agencies to the situation, and the International Red Cross is there. So it's a very dire situation. We have tens of thousands of people marching across the border, then you have to confront this. And it's not a usual situation for any country, and especially, I'm sorry, for a European country, where you have artillery shelling civilian shelling towns. Water pumps, churches, hospitals, kindergartens, you know. It's all on our television. Of course, Ambassador Sergeyev claimed today when this child was killed that his parents were acting because they were paid by Russian television. You know, I don't even want to. It's sinking to a new low if this is going to be the only explanation of the situation one can produce.
The killing of two Russian journalists by the Ukrainian military was condemned by the head of UNESCO, the United Nations Education, Scientific, and Cultural Organization. Sophie Althwaite reports.
The killing of two Russian journalists in Ukraine has been condemned by the head of the UN cultural agency, UNESCO. In a statement issued on Thursday, Irina Bokova said she was deeply shocked by the death of Igor Korneliuk, a television reporter, and Anton Voloshin, a sound engineer. The two reporters, who worked for a Russian television station, were reporting on fighting near the city of Lugansk, where they were hit by mortar fire on Tuesday. Ms. Bukova said the work of journalists, especially in situations of tension, is essential to nourish the informed debate necessary for promoting renewed dialogue and mutual understanding. She called on all warring parties to respect the civilian status of journalists and let them carry out their important professional activities in safe conditions. According to UNESCO, 5 journalists have been killed in Ukraine since January this year. Sophie Althwaite, United Nations.
Russia's permanent representative to the UN, Vitaly Churkin, stopped short of calling Ukraine's UN representative a liar on Friday, but not by much. We'll have more on that later in this newscast. A top Shiite cleric in Iraq has joined the growing calls for the country's prime minister to form a new government. Iraq's most influential Shiite cleric, Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, issued a statement Friday calling on Iraq's diverse political parties to move quickly to form a new government. Ahmed al-Safi, a leading Shiite cleric and Sistani's representative in the Shiite holy city of Karbala, said that all political blocs should stick to the timing required in the constitution to convene a new parliament by July 2nd. After a week of losses of real estate and military assets to the forces of the Islamic State of Iraq in the Levant, the Iraqi government says its military is fighting back, with a claim on Friday that 40 insurgents were killed during a reported attack on the country's main oil refinery in the town of Baji, 140 miles north of Baghdad. In his weekly address, Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki denied that Iraq's security forces were too weak to defend their country from ISIL. Many, however, say the problem is one of motivation. The current Iraqi government is widely seen by Iraqis as an instrument of U.S. control of their country, and thus not worth fighting and dying for. One such person is Sami Rosuli, a founder of the Muslim Peacemaker Teams. He says Iraq's military forces, unlike the ISIL fighters, lack conviction and a sense of purpose. He spoke with Radio VR's Crystal Park.
I don't think what Maliki has said is believable, because simply the current army is not well trained, and mostly they were recruited after 2003 when the old army had been disbanded. And what we see now under the auspices of the title ISIS, there are many groups. ISIS doesn't represent nothing but a few fighters who were trained in Turkey, financed by Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and Qatar, but they were trained by the US and Israelis to launch so-called the Arab Spring across Arab countries. ISIS, they are a group of Muslim extremists who are misled, and they are mostly from Central Asia, like Afghanistan and Chechnya, some of them from North Africa and some parts of the Arab world. But what happened in the province of Nineveh is a large number of, under the auspices of ISIS, there were the old army fighters who are generals, well-trained, good planners. What they needed heavy equipment that they got it when the new army in the province of Nineveh fled the fighting scene and left behind all this expensive equipment in the hand of so-called ISIS. But also there are many of young, angry Sunni population of the western and northern part of Iraq who got neglected by the central government and marginalized for almost a decade since 2003. So those are unemployed, and they found a reason for them to revolt. And that's why they are advancing and coming south to take over the many cities, large or small, south of Nineveh, but north of Baghdad.
The latest round of the P5+1 talks with Iran closed Friday with a less optimistic tone than the parties had expressed over the course of the week. We have this report from Press TV's Kovi Tavwe.
Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif says differences remain between Tehran and the P5+1 group on several key issues over Iran's nuclear program.
We witnessed in this round of negotiations was entry into the drafting of the agreement. Of course, we cannot yet say that there is a common text. In some cases, there may be agreement on certain parts of the text, and in many cases, there is difference of view, both about the content and also the ways and means for drafting the agreement. So far, we have agreed about the title, but there's also agreement about the general framework. Possibly, one can say that there's no basic difference about the prelude of the agreement, but as far as basic issues are concerned, there's generally difference about the content and also how to just draft that agreement.
Zarif said Iran entered the talks with goodwill, adding that it will not back down from its nuclear rights. Zarif said the other side lacked seriousness in the negotiations and pushed excessive demands. Zarif said that Iran and the P5+1 group will resume nuclear negotiations in Vienna on July the 2nd. He was speaking to reporters after representatives from Iran and the P5+1 group wrapped up 5 days of nuclear talks aimed at drafting a final nuclear agreement. The two sides reached an interim deal back in November. It will expire on July 20th.
Russia's permanent representative to the UN, Vitaly Churkin, stopped short of calling Ukraine's UN representative a liar Friday, but not by much. Churkin offered a detailed response to an earlier press conference by Ukraine's ambassador to the UN at a press conference in New York late Friday.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for coming to this press conference. I'm going to do it in two capacities, both as ambassador of Russia and maybe at some points as president of the Security Council. I'll be frank with you, I was provoked into this initiative by the press conference which was conducted earlier today by my Ukrainian colleague, Ambassador Sergeyev. And usually I try to do my best not to criticize my colleagues directly, but unfortunately this time I was provoked into some criticism which will follow. But of course, the most important thing is not surprise at some of the things which were said by Ambassador Sergeyev, but also at the message which he was trying to deliver. He described some elements of what he said was going to be President Poroshenko's peace initiative, and while he was doing that, he repeatedly said that not only sort of the entire world has embraced this initiative, but also President Putin and Foreign Minister Lavrov supported it. I double-checked, and I'm authorized to say that this is not true. It is premature to talk about our support for President Poroshenko's initiative, at least for the reason that we haven't seen it yet. This initiative was discussed, was outlined by Pyotr Poroshenko to President Putin in their phone conversation yesterday. And President Putin made some comments, particularly emphasizing the need to stop fire immediately and making some other comments with regard to this initiative. And in the discussion, in the phone conversation which Foreign Minister Lavrov had today with the new Foreign Minister of Ukraine, that initiative was not even sort of discussed in any detail. And I'd like to call your attention to the remarks which were made on the subject by Foreign Minister Lavrov at his press conference in Baku the day before yesterday, where he emphasized that whatever initiative comes out of Kyiv, it should not be an ultimatum and it should not resemble ethnic cleansing. Now, there's some personal comments on what Ambassador Sergeyev said. I mean, if he outlined what will be coming as President Poroshenko's initiative correctly, then I'm afraid that it may mean a lot of trouble, because things like a 10-kilometer buffer zone along the border, corridor through which people who want to leave eastern Ukraine would be able to go into Russia, disarmament in eastern Ukraine, all those things may well mean more bloodshed and even intensification of bloodshed rather than a peace initiative. But we'll see. We have not seen, as I say, the final product yet. When it comes out, then Moscow will form its attitude. But it is very premature to to talk about Russian support. As a matter of fact, we are a little bit surprised that some of our foreign colleagues are rushing to support something which has not been presented yet. It is a serious subject which requires serious attention rather than sort of propaganda support of everything which might be coming out of Kyiv. Now, some other things which I have to respond to, which I heard Ambassador Sergeyev say today in this room. First, a startling comment from him that the Ukrainian forces had orders not to use heavy weapons. How come aviation jet fighters were used in the attack, missile attack on Lugansk administrative building a couple of weeks ago? A jet fighter fired missiles at the building. Heavy artillery have been shelling cities in eastern Ukraine. To claim that heavy weapons were not involved is really mind-boggling. An even more mind-boggling claim was that illegal groups are fighting civilians with Grad systems in eastern Ukraine. This narrative that somehow civilians die because the local armed group, local resistant groups, are firing at their own towns is really something which stretches, I think, even the Ukrainian propaganda. Now, he went on even further, and this, I think, maybe the most troubling part of his press conference, when he described the situation when two Russian TV correspondents were captured by Ukrainian authorities, brought to Kyiv, beaten up, bruises all over the body, and then paraded before TV screens. He said that they apologized to the Ukrainian people. I mean, this kind of treatment is even unacceptable for prisoners of war, let alone journalists. When you hold people captive, beat them up, and then put them in front of television cameras. In fact, a part of the appearance I saw showed that they displayed a lot of courage. When this young fella was asked how come bruises were on his face, he responded by a famous line from a very famous Soviet movie, "I fell when I came to, my hand was in plaster of Paris." Unfortunately, or fortunately for us, unfortunately for the Ukrainians, they did not see the contempt which he displayed to his captors in those words. And now, a final maybe thing, commenting specifically on what Ambassador Sergeyev, this is something he has been repeating again and again throughout various Security Council meetings, and also he repeated that today, that the Cossacks, some of whom may have found themselves in eastern Ukraine, somehow a part of the Russian armed force. This is simply not true. There is a law on the Cossacks, and there is nothing of that law which makes formations of the Cossacks, let alone individual Cossacks, members of the Russian armed force. So this, and there were some other things which I'm not even going into. The discourse which Ambassador Sergeyev went to on history after the coup in Kyiv in February, somehow my old colleague started developing a new line of history, starting with startling the world by claiming on the 4th of March that actually Ukrainian Nazi collaborators had not killed anybody, that all that was an invention of the Soviet Union. So in his history, theory of history, I am not even going. Now, another thing which was addressed by Ambassador Sergeyev and which I'd like to inform you about is this request, which we, as a presidency of the Security Council, received from the delegation of Ukraine to conduct a Security Council meeting on the report of the Office of Commissioner for Human Rights in Ukraine, or Shimonovich, another report. And actually, he stated that that was kind of an unparalleled situation in history, that a meeting was not called. That, of course, is not true. The requests which come from various delegations are not acted on automatically by members of the Security Council. The Presidency and other members of the Security Council have to decide whether to how to respond to those requests, especially if it's not an emergency meeting request, which was not the case in this request by the Ukrainian delegation. But also, in our view, and that's why we are reluctant to call that meeting, and not that we are don't want to discuss Ukraine. As you know, we have had 18, meetings on Ukraine in various formats in the past 3 months, some of them convened on the initiative of the Russian Federation. The last one, last Monday, when we presented our draft resolution on Ukraine. But there were two sort of questions of principle. One, it is a report which was not commissioned by the Security Council, and it is a report on human rights. And we do have, and the group was invited by the Kyiv authorities. So if they want to discuss it, they can discuss it in Kyiv. Maybe they could go to Human Rights Council, but the Security Council is not about human rights. We even don't have experts on human rights here. We are discussing matters of international peace and security. So in my mind, as someone who has been trying to sort of hold the integrity of the Security Council, it's very dangerous to start discussing human rights reports, because we'll overshadow the Human Rights Council and maybe doom the Human Rights Council. In fact, already the prerogatives of the Security Council have been frayed, because we go into humanitarian matters, we go into this, we go into that. This is too much for the Security Council. This is one thing. The second thing is that it did seem to us that it was an attempt to take attention away from the actual drama of the situation in eastern Ukraine. You have fighting, you have a crisis, to which some members of the Security Council refuse to respond, in my view, abrogating their responsibility as members of the Security Council, because if there is fighting, a crisis which has national dimension, then and which is on the agenda of the Security Council, then the Security Council must try to take steps to stop this crisis, the fighting, as quickly as possible. Unfortunately, our Western colleagues, Western members of the Security Council, apparently decided to let it go, to let the military scenario play out. So in the context of this fighting and bloodshed in eastern Ukraine, to start discussing like human rights report, which is not the prerogative of the Security Council to do, in our view, is wrong. But anyway, today in consultations, we had a discussion with the members of the Security Council, so I wouldn't rule out that quite soon we'll have a meeting of the Security Council on Ukraine. But of course, it will not cover just this report, but the entire dramatic situation there. Unfortunately, I have no illusions about the ability of the Security Council to act, because the Russian delegation tried a number of times. We tried by trying to deliver a short statement calling on the end of violence in support of the Geneva communique of April 17 and in support of OEC roadmap. We tried in a more elaborate ways, introducing two draft resolutions of the Security Council, then merging them into one and having a discussion with our members of the Security Council about it. Unfortunately, our initial impression that maybe there is a way for us to agree on a resolution which would then have an impact on the situation in Ukraine, that assessment turned out to be inaccurate. That the next meeting showed that Western members of the Security Council were engaged in this old exercise of stonewalling. But anyway, it may well be that very shortly we will have that meeting, but certainly it will have to deal with the entire spectrum of the situation in Ukraine. Now, on this report itself, Ambassador Sergeyev did not hide his pleasure about the content of the report, and I understand why. Because I must say very frankly, it completely repeats the narrative of the Kyiv authorities. And one marvels at the pensmanship of those who are writing this report in order to suit their own political inclinations. There is no hint of objectivity in that report. And to understand that, one only has to read the first page. And from the first page, I'll give you maybe two or three quotes. Paragraph 5. There has also been more regular and intense fighting, as the government has been trying to restore peace and security over the eastern regions of Donetsk and Lugansk through security operations involving its armed forces. No reference to fighting, no reference to shelling, involving security operations involving its armed forces. And they are trying to restore peace and security. I mean, you could apply this kind of description to any situation. You could say, they could say in their next report on Syria, that the government of Syria, Damascus, is trying to restore peace and security in their country. Isn't it true? They are trying to restore peace and security in their country. So this kind of politicized statement, feeding directly into the narrative of Kyiv authorities, to me is something not really worthy of High Commissioner for Human Rights and their office. Now, the people in eastern Ukraine, they are increasingly being caught in the crossfire between the Ukrainian military and the armed groups. Crossfire. So, I mean, it's just they are sitting somewhere in between in no man's land, and they're shelling from, like, fighting from both directions. This is not true.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.